Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome. Hey everybody, welcome back to One Broken Mom. I have with me on the show today, Michael Anthony. Michael is an author, mentor, and advocate for adult survivors of child abuse, and somebody that I discovered through social media with a lot of the hashtags that I follow, which is mental health awareness and CPTSD. And he's on the show today to tell us about how to become unbroken, which I am intrigued to for having a show that's called One Broken Mom. So I would love to hear what he talks about and how he brings this forward. And I don't want to go too much into my intro with him because I want him to tell his story because it's just like, it's pretty gripping. So welcome to the show, Michael.
Hey, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I'm glad to have the opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we are Pacific Northwesterners together. So he was down in the Portland area. I'm up outside of the Seattle region here. So, and this is sometime around early July that we're having this conversation. I want to put that into context because there's a lot going on outside of our windows right now in the year 2020. And most people will listen to this episode right away when it's published, but some people might end up coming back around to this, you know, much later. And, you know, I've been making a point to try to have the podcast, you know, people talk about evergreen content, but I also think there's something valuable about a time capsule, you know, to be able to kind of speak to the moment. Because when we go back or, you know, go forward a few years, I feel like we're going to just kind of have our minds blown, you know, at all the stuff that's been heaping on and everything that still has yet to come here in 2020. So, you know, how has this been for like your 6-7 months of pandemic living into everything else that's, you know, kind of becoming the weird, you know, the weird year of our lives?
Yeah. You know, I think it's really interesting. I think that a lot of people like me who come from chaotic backgrounds of trauma, we are able to thrive in situations like this. It's not outside the realm of norm nor possibility that we would be in this place where we have to figure some shit out. I think that it's impactful in my personal life because a lot of my friends have become unemployed and I watch the struggles that they have. And as far as myself, like I'm good. Because I just think about it like this, like I'm not surprised, like literally flying snakes could be next. And I'd be like, all right, cool. We'll figure out how to deal with it. I mean, yes, to an extent it sucks. Isolation sucks. Getting out of the flow of the normality of life sucks. You know, I'm very much a habit-based person, wake up, go to the gym, do my thing, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of like my normal ebb and flow of my day from working at coffee shops to hitting the gym, that gets interrupted, right? So it's kind of, I had a little bit of a period of time where I was like, okay, now I'm in flux. How do I get back into habit and routine? But as a whole, I think two things. One, you know, I think it's really important that we do be safe because on one hand you go, okay, if COVID is as bad as they say it is, then I need to kind of do my part. But the other part is like, if I don't, then what if? And as far as the Black Lives Matter movement and what's happening in the world right now, it's far overdue. I'm glad it's happening. I think that until, you know, things change, we keep going. And to me, I would rather die than not have freedom and equality. So I'm out here marching, I'm out here protesting, I'm out here putting petitions up because I think it's necessary. And I think for a lot of people, that's the state of the world we live in right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've talked with other people about, you know, the effects, the impacts of trauma. It, you know, sometimes just looking outside and, you know, when I make statements, it's not because I know anything, I'm just making an observation. And for people that haven't really had to sit with that uncomfortableness of what's going on and all the shit inside their head and in their heart, Times like this feel like really just bizarre to them and unsettling for them, because they are out of like their norm, and they're kind of sitting there forced to look at, you know, everything out on the table of, wow, I distract myself a lot and now I can't. And now I'm sitting at home with somebody that I've managed to tolerate, but now I can't. And now I've got all this, you know, I've lost my job, or I've got to, you know, some people are dealing with having to school their kids, and that's not the norm for them. But it is the people that I feel like this is like, okay, cool. Like, I've learned to survive through, you know, not knowing what was coming up next, or the erratic, irrational behaviors, or, you know, really ugliness of everybody around me. This is just another version of life. And there is that weird thriving in the chaos moment for a lot of people, but it's the ones that aren't used to that, that are really kind of, that feel like they're struggling through that. I mean, have you seen that with some of your friends that, you know, haven't kind of gone through the same things that you have?
Yeah. I think everybody has their good days and bad days right now. And, you know, I always think about it like this: if you can have more good hours than bad hours, then you end up having a good day. And so how do you kind of translate that into weeks and months? And, you know, you're going to have a hard time. Like, that's the nature of the world, but what are you willing to do to work through it? Right. And I don't think it's fair to say that everyone can step into this and thrive, because that's just not the case. Many of us have never been in this situation before. And in fact, none of us, no one has ever been in this situation before. It's the first time ever. So like, what the fuck are we doing? We're figuring it out day to day. I think right now, however, is a great case for personal responsibility and stepping into growth and figuring out how to navigate what's next in your life. You know, if you're just sitting around and watching Netflix all day, you're probably not taking advantage of what's here at hand. However, you might also need that. So if you need to watch Netflix all day, then so be it. But that said, you know, you have to think about right now being an opportunity to create growth in your life. And yes, you're going to have our days. Yes, it's scary. Yes, you know, even walking outside, I think we are so weary of each other. And we've already had tension in America. Tension has been something that existed here forever. And now it's tenfold. You know, now between police and each other and the world and the government, it's just kind of like we are constantly at this tipping point. So what can you do to take care of yourself? How can you implement and deploy self-care? How do you put yourself first? And ultimately, how do you figure out how to navigate this? And I think that's by looking internally and saying, okay, this is what I need right now. So yeah, mm-hmm. You're going to have good days. You're going to have bad days.
Yeah. I found that my theme, you know, I didn't intend for this when I started the season, but it's evolving into this because it feels like it's necessary, which is really touching on the topic of resilience and how to build resilience in people. And so a lot of times, and I've got another guest coming up in a couple of weeks whose specialty is resilience training, you know, for it, like identifying it and kind of building grit in everybody. So I am looking forward to this conversation with you for that reason, because I believe everything about you is the epitome of that. And surviving, you know, something really extensive and brutal at times for you. And so what I'd like to do is, because there's so many things that we can unpack and spread out all over the table today, I want to start with an introduction. And so I'd like for you to just tell everybody that's listening and watching this on YouTube, like, who are you? Who's Michael Anthony? And why are we sitting here? You know, why are we sitting here together and having a conversation today about this?
Yeah, totally. And I'll give you the elevator pitch, right? To go all the way into it would take hours. The Michael, the person sitting in front of you that you're hearing right now, I created. It is a caricature of the person that I wanted to be. I grew up in the Midwest, Indianapolis. My mother was a drug addict and alcoholic. She was hyper abusive. She actually cut my finger off when I was 4 years old. My stepfather, who she married when I was 6, was literally the most abusive human being you could ever possibly imagine. When you think to yourself, oh, I hope that person's never my stepdad, that's what I got. I never met my father. My home life was insane, because while all this abuse was happening in the home, we were constantly homeless, power getting turned off, water getting turned off, only eating at school. Sometimes I'd be living with strangers. I'd live with my grandma from time to time. This is all while growing up in the Mormon church. So then there is that aspect. By the time I'm 12, my grandmother adopted me. She had taken one of my other brothers, and she was this extremely racist person. She's a white woman. from this little town called Sunbright, Tennessee, population 500 people. She never saw a person of color until she was 29 years old. And so now as I'm heading into my teens, a super fragile time in a human being's life, my mom's in and out of rehab. I had a restraining order on her and my stepfather. My racist grandma's raising me in an almost predominantly black neighborhood. Well, I'm going to an all-black school, but I'm not allowed to have black friends come into my home. My uncle, who's in prison, is a part of the Aryan Brotherhood. And I have this weird juxtaposition of trying to navigate this while also trying to keep the lights on, selling drugs, breaking into houses, stealing cars, running with guns, hurting people, failing. I had straight F's in high school. I got almost expelled twice while, you know, and this is like the 2000s. So you could be an athlete and like they would just push you through. And so because I was an athlete, I was captain of the football team, captain of the wrestling team. You know, they kind of just pushed me through. And finally, I had a teacher my last year of high school, Mr. Bush, shout out, who looked at me and said, you know what, I'm not passing you. You have to go to summer school. I didn't get to graduate on time. And I had to go to summer school as a senior in high school because I have straight F's in most of my classes. And he refused to let me continue down that path. And it was one of the most pivotal, life-changing moments you could ever imagine. And as I headed into my 20s, I kind of figured out how to navigate corporate America. By the time I was 20 years old, I was working for a Fortune 50 company, which is impossible for a kid from the hood, but I figured it out. And then I started making a ton of money and everything turned to shit. Because what I figured out is if your goals are not in line with your values, then you're going to end up in the juxtaposition of chaos. And so now I'm making all this money. I have the nicest car, all the best clothes. I'm 350 pounds. I'm smoking a pack of cigarettes a day, getting drunk every night, having all kinds of anonymous sex and relationships. And my life is spiraling into chaos while I have multiple girlfriends who don't know each other exist, while I'm running two businesses. And all of a sudden, I started having 5 panic attacks a day, which is reasonable. And I had this moment where one morning before I'm getting ready to go and do this wedding photography convention, because I'm now a former international wedding photographer, I was like, if I don't change my life right now, it's going to end. And that was 8 years ago. And so since then, I have been on this healing journey where I said to myself in this moment, I was like, no matter what it takes, no matter the cost, no matter the effort, no matter the energy, I'm going to get healthy. Because I had promised myself when I was a kid, I was not going to go down this path. And yet I found myself there because I had not yet developed A, the tools, B, the understanding, and 3, the self-love. I guess it'd be C, not 3. And what happened was I had this moment where I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. And slowly it transformed not only into understanding, but an education by necessity. While many people go to college and spend years and years and years trying to understand human psychology, I just went to the library and I bought a lot of fucking books and I went to a lot of conferences. And I would be the only civilian in a room full of doctors at exposés, just like learning and talking, symposiums, not exposés, sorry. And so now, fast forward a few more years, I am a coach, I'm a mentor, I'm an author, I have podcasts, I have traveled the world talking about it and being an advocate for adult survivors of child abuse. And you found me on social media because of something that I posted, and that is how I'm sitting here having this conversation with you.
And that was the elevator pitch?
Yeah, that's the quick version.
Well, I'm mind blown all the time as I'm listening to everything there and just kind of like, you know, it's impressive. I mean, and I have to say congratulations to you for that. And if no one's told you that, hopefully people have told you that it is amazing to do that. Those moments where you have that clarity and that focus and then the gumption to act on it is really a gift. I mean, it's a gift that not everybody actually ends up getting in there. And so sometimes people have this awareness, I think, of like, I really should do something different, but then nobody ever really does that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you did. Yeah. And you said that earlier, you know, it's like, it's hard. It's not fair to have everybody assume that they all can do this, you know, that because, you know, I've studied with resilience and some people are, you know, dopamine receptors, serotonin, you know, processing. Some people can be born with it in the brain, easier times to be able to do it. Some people can learn it, which I think is what part of your mission is to redefine your life mm-hmm. after going through all of that. And so, you know, anybody listening, you know, I always sit there and think about, man, I hear these stories from some of my guests like you and I go, shit, there was nothing wrong. You know, we do that comparison, you know, mm-hmm. of how bad was your trauma. But yeah, that's amazing. you know, again, like I said, we have so much to unpack and where to go, you know, where to begin with all of this. You know, you do bring up the fact that having a racist grandparent who then ends up becoming your caregiver, you know, what was that like for you? I mean, what part of that is a part of your trauma history that maybe still has an impact on you today? And maybe that's not a good way of asking that question, but I want to bring it up because we do talk about the trauma of racism just alone, right? You know, deduct abuse and abandonment and all the other things there, but just the messaging of feeling not good enough or not as good or whatever it is. I mean, that alone is traumatic in its entirety.
Totally. And I think the thing now, it doesn't impact me because I've worked through it, because I understand it, because I get a look back and go, oh, okay, I understand generationally how we get to this place. As a kid, I didn't. And so, you know, being young and in that situation, I have been called both white trash and black trash. And, you know, that kind of comes with the territory. And growing up, it was never surprising to me to be in the car with my grandmother, to go down the street, to be somewhere with my uncle when he was in and out of prison, and just hear the most insane racist shit. And to me, I thought that was normal, because you only know normal as a child based on your experience. And so I don't know anything different. And then it was really interesting because my mother would frequently only date black men. And I felt like that was this weird thing that she did to like piss my grandma off. And so that always intersected. And so now by the time that she adopts me when I'm 12, and I'm super thankful for that. So I want to be clear, because I would not be here without her, but that doesn't mean I didn't get fucked up in the process. And so now I'm in middle school and I'm living with her heading into high school. And there is just this constant tension between her and I, especially as I'm starting to develop friendships, as I'm starting to understand who I am, music, clothes, the way I carry myself in the world, the people I'm running the streets with, being involved in certain things. And we clashed and we clashed and we clashed until ultimately when I was a senior in high school, junior, I might've been a junior actually, outside of just living there, I didn't talk to her. I didn't interact with her. I just kind of like would come and go as I pleased. Plus I was out running the streets and shit anyway. So, you know, I might not get home till 3 o'clock in the morning. And that was something that I didn't recognize immediately, but as I started heading into my late teens, I was like, oh, I'm having an identity crisis. That was what came from that. And a lot of biracial people do, a lot of multicultural people do. And I've had these conversations with friends who have grown up in similar instances, and they say the same thing. They're like, I had no idea who I was. And that was what had carried with me into my 20s. And that was something that I had to kind of figure out where worthiness and self-love comes into play, because I felt unworthy of love, of support, of care. And that's piled on, not just from the racism, but also because of not being able to have an understanding about my value in the world. And not valuing myself and judging my own skin color and judging my friend's skin color. And, you know, all of these things that kind of go along with it. And now as an adult, and I think like once you're 30, you're an adult. When you're 20s, you're still stupid. And so when in my 20s, I am still doing all these things kind of indicative of that former self. And as I get older, I kind of go, okay, no, I'm totally comfortable with who I am. A lot of that's from doing the work. But then the other part of it is like, I don't give a fuck what people think about me anymore.
How do you think you establish sense of identity with somebody that has the conflict, if we want to call it that, of the two races of like not being good enough for this one, or the feelings that you kind of had, not being good enough to be white, not being good enough to be black, being too white to be black. And I think that was something that came off of your website that I saw mm-hmm. there. How does one kind of overcome that then? You know,
I don't think it's easy. I don't think that there's any like formulaic way to do it. It just kind of happens once you get to, you really have to establish this unfaltering self-belief, and also combine that with the idea that you cannot let other people impact the way that you feel about yourself. I say this all the time, and I said it a minute ago, I do not care what people think about me. I don't. I don't. And that's not armor. It's just truth. It is because your opinion is your opinion. I know who I am. I'm super confident in that. I love myself and I don't fucking care what you think about me. That said, that does not mean I do not value the thoughts and opinions of the people in my life who deserve to have that say. If I am being an asshole, I want my people to tell me, right? But if you think that we're going to have a conversation that somehow is going to make your life better based on the color of my skin because you want to figure out how I fit into what you believe is the world, we're not going to, I don't give a shit about you. We have nothing to talk about. So what, to answer that question, I think that you just have to get to this place where it becomes true that for you, if you, especially if I'm talking to biracial people right now, if you believe that you have to honor other people's thought and beliefs of you, then you need to reassess the people that you're spending your time with first. And secondly, you need to figure out what is it going to take where your self-belief becomes so utterly grandiose that no one can penetrate it to negatively impact the way that you think about yourself.
That's great. Yeah. What would have made a difference for you as a kid, you think? Because I, you know, part of this is, you know, can anybody learn from that experience that may be dealing with this right now in their own families that are listening to this? You know, you mentioned having a teacher that just didn't let you down or, you know, refused to let you, you know, kind of skate by. But if it's difficult, you know, with a well-meaning parent who's not trying to, you know, devalue that identity, but maybe struggling to understand, you know, have you thought about that? Like, what would you tell a parent right now?
Yeah, totally. And you know, what's really interesting is I get questions from parents all the time and I'm not a parent. So I always want to be really clear about that. And I probably won't ever be, it's not in the cards for me. And but I think about it. I know what it's like to be a child. I know what I needed then. And I always tell people this, if your child, especially regardless of race, is struggling with identity or understanding who they are, you need to give them the space to explore that. The biggest pushback and fighting that I ever did with adults was in these moments where I was trying to get an understanding of who I was. And they would try to push back at that and say, oh, no, we believe that you should be this way. Right. It was, I couldn't only be the jock or the band geek, the things that I did, or the video game nerd or the stoner or the thug, which was all part of my nomenclature. It was always a pushback of who I was. And I think that if you can give your child the space to explore, and they're going to fuck up, they're going to make mistakes, they're going to piss you off, they're probably going to get suspended from school. I don't know. Right. You have to let them do it. I mean, I'm not saying you have to, you give them the permission to do what I did. Like, I would hope most kids don't have to be in this situation where they're running the streets with guns at 2 o'clock in the morning, but it happens. And you have to kind of think about it from this perspective. When you were a kid, what pissed you off more than anything when it came to your parents? Mm-hmm. And it's them trying to control you.
Yeah, for sure.
Ultimately, let me say this. We're ultimately going to get to the place that we're going to get in life, and we can either do it with support or we can do it fighting you tooth and nail all the way up the road.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I agree. And that happens to people even more subtly. Like, it doesn't have to be like really overbearing or, you know, overwhelming. I mean, there's, you know, lots of families end up with this idea that that you can shape the direction a person goes. And we're beginning to understand and learn. Sometimes some of us do it in a harder way, but, you know, we are individuals. We are going to be who we're going to be. Mm-hmm. But this, totally. And I've talked about like the tabula rasa, this idea that it's a blank slate and you can just write on there, like, we're going to make you into this type of a person. You're going to go get your engineering degree. You're going to go do this and you can't do this. You're not meant to do this. And that is frustrating as a kid and a teenager. I know a lot of my anger started to build up in me in my teen years from having to fight against the not listening and not allowing of my own individuation and individuality, or ignoring it or taunting it or, you know, dismissing it completely altogether. And there's a lot of that, you know, like simmering, I call it my simmering rage that's deep inside of me from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, hopefully there's some kids listening to this too, but you know, you have to remember your parents don't know anything. We don't, none of us do. We're all just trying to figure it out. And it's a scary concept, this thing called communication. But sometimes you literally have to go to the people in your life and be like, look, you're suffocating me. I cannot seem to step into the person that I want to be or believe that I am because you have these ideals about who it is that you think I'm supposed to be. And because of that, and it's really hard because children often don't have the communication skills to dictate this, but there's always a way to say, hey, I need space. And especially in your teens, if I would have the ability and knew that I was allowed to say, I need space, please let me try to figure out who I am, because if you don't, I'm going to resent you. And then when I'm 19, I'm never going to talk to you again. It might have ended up being a different scenario, not only with my mother, but also with my grandmother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I hope that I do that with my own kids, but we do bump into it. But I know that they've had some difficulties with their father, because that was what his mindset was that you needed to do it this way, you need to do it this way. And it really, especially with my son, he became almost frozen by the conflict of, I want to do it this way, I'm trying to think this through on my own, but yet I have you right here always telling me the different way to do it and what I'm doing mm-hmm. is wrong and what I'm doing is wrong. And when I gave him just the freedom to just kind of figure it all out and just watch, make sure it's safe, you know, but just allow him to go through it, then his own problem solving skills really did come online, because he tested it, he failed, he figured it out, he went back, and you know, and it is important, you know, to stand back and to do that. You know, you said that you were able to kind of get away from your mom as young as 18 years old, which is really, I mean, that's pretty young for a kid to kind of have this awareness of cutoff. Some of us get into our 40s before we decide, wow, I don't really need to hold on to these anchors anymore. I really need to let this go. How did you come at such a young age to that realization that there were a lot of people that just needed to leave your life? I mean, obviously the trauma and the abuse that you went through is part of it, but some people take a long time to get to a place mm-hmm. of knowing when they have to start letting people go.
Yeah, you know, I think it comes back to, I've always had this really acute awareness that something in my world was askew. It didn't make sense to me. Here's what happened, I think. I lived with probably 40 different families for periods of time in my childhood, and I noticed that the majority of them, their homes were not like my home. And so that gave me the indicator, oh, something here is not copacetic. This is not correct. That's part of it. The other part of it is my mother constantly embarrassed me and more so put my life and my brother's lives at risk between her drunk driving, her driving intoxicated. I mean, she threatened to kill us multiple times, drive the car off the road in the family, kill us in our sleep, all this shit, right? And so because I lacked any type of self-esteem as a child, I would do whatever it took to get attention from other people. And I recognized in myself, actually as a teenager, oh, that's the same thing my mother does, but she does that with drugs and alcohol. I don't want that to be a part of my life moving forward. And so we'd go to AA with her, NA with her, or we'd sit in the back. She would blame us. And a lot of it became from embarrassment and blame and me just being like, I am so tired of dealing with your shit. And what happened was I made this decision when I was 12. I asked my grandmother to put a restraining order on her. That was my choice at 12 years old because I thought to myself, I need her away from me. And so she did that, and eventually my grandma let her come back and be a part of our lives. Well, in high school, she started going down a further path, and I actually put a picture of my report card in my book because I think it's really important. I had straight F's and D's for my freshman and sophomore year. My junior year, I put a restraining order on my mother again. I had straight A's my junior year of high school. Right? Because I had removed that chaos from my life. And it was in that moment that I recognized, oh, if I'm going to be successful in life, this person who is so incredibly toxic has to be entirely removed. And I told her, one day she walked into my bedroom. It was like 9 o'clock at night. She was drunk off her ass and she started attacking me because she couldn't figure out how to turn on the computer. And she was blaming me. Like, it's just this drunken thing. Right? And the next day I told her, you're never allowed to talk to me again. You're not allowed to be a part of my life. I don't want this. And so until the day that she died, I literally only saw her two more times. And that was a decision that I made for self-preservation. Very similarly with my grandmother, but she had started to get sick and I emotionally couldn't handle it. So it kind of happened by proxy. And I've done that with now as an adult, understanding, looking at the value that people bring in my life. I always think about it like this. Do people bring value to my life or do they take value from me? And if you are a succubus and you take from me, I have to remove you. Why? Self-preservation. And so if you are, and I deal with this with people all the time, and especially in my coaching, if you are in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and you still have a parent who is in your life who is detrimental to everything that it is that you want to do or accomplish, you have to ask yourself a really hard fucking question. And that is, what am I willing to do to have the life that I want to have? And sometimes that means taking parents out of your life forever. Also, that may mean boundaries. Sometimes a parent or a sibling or a spouse or a partner, whomever, will get it. You'll go, okay, look, because of the situation that you've put me in, I'm not going to have connection with you for the next 6 months. I'm not going to respond to texts. I'm not going to call you. We're not going to have any interaction. I don't want to see your face because you are taking away from my life. That's like an easy baby step. And maybe it starts with 4 days, right? So whatever that is, it starts there. And as you move further into it, it becomes longer and longer and longer. All of this, here's where people, I think, get lost all the time. Self-care is not selfish. And removing people who steal from you is not selfish. It is self-preservation. But you have to recognize that you don't owe anybody shit. There is nobody on planet Earth that gets to take from you and continue to take from you and deserve to take from you unless you allow it. You, and this is the hard truth, and I'm sorry, this is going to make you uncomfortable, you're doing this to yourself because you're allowing this to continue to take place. And I know it's so hard to hear that because we come from this idea, especially in American society, in Western society, we owe everything to our parents. They're greater than everything else. Oh my God, they feed us, they clothe us, blah, blah, blah. My parents fucking sucked. Like, your parents may suck too. So ask yourself this question. If you had the ability to live the life that you wanted and you had someone who was easily removable, because we often remove friends, no problem, would you continue to allow that person to be in your life, right? Or here comes personal responsibility and accountability again. It's a different level because it is hard, but you have to look at this and go, okay, if I'm going to be accountable for myself, I can't continue to put my mental and emotional energy into defending my livelihood against this person who totally seeps from it. So it's a difficult conversation. Most people aren't willing to do it, but that's why most people continue to live in that place where it's constantly a threat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why I've talked about this on the show, because I agree that a lot of people have all the heaping piles of guilt and shame placed on them for even thinking about cutting off family members, you know, and it's not just parents. Sometimes it's your siblings, it's everybody, you mm-hmm. know, in the family, because, you know, sometimes it's just because the emotional connection and the environment with them just draws you down, or you slip back into, I found for myself, slipping back into the old role was so much easier around those people, because it was like, it's so lockstep of the behaviors and no one else growing from them or growing out of them, that it was like, man, I can't even go back anymore. Like, I can't do this. Cause every time mm-hmm. I do, I feel my chest tighten. I feel my anger rise. I feel, you know, and I'm sitting here having the same fucking arguments with people over the same stupid shit. And, you know, I'm just like, yeah, done, you know?
Sometimes the levee breaks and you just have to decide, am I going to try to keep to rebuild it, or am I going to move?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I'm glad you said the thing about self-care and selfishness, because that is one of those messages we get, especially when we have a parent like what you're describing as well, which is the everything's our fault, you know, that our needs needed to be second to them, and anything that they had going on was because you didn't do enough, mm-hmm. or they came to you all the time to solve their problems. And somehow you grew up with this idea that I have to take care of my parents, which is pretty fucked up, because kids aren't supposed to do that.
Yeah.
But then when you decide to choose yourself, then it is, oh, well, now you're being selfish. And that is a bullshit attitude, you know?
Yeah.
Are you the oldest? I'm just curious, listening to you, having siblings, you know, where did you fall in birth order?
Yeah, so I have an older sister. She actually, we have different fathers, the siblings and I. So she grew up with her father. Hmm. And then I'm second. And then I've got three younger brothers.
Okay.
Different dads in there, so.
Yeah. Did you feel like you were an older sibling?
Well, yeah, my sister, because her father took her, which is amazing. I've never been envious of that. I've always been like, I'm really happy that happened for her, because she did not have to experience the vast majority of the shit that I went through. And I think that, you know, sometimes that's just life. And so, yeah, I mean, I definitely played the older brother role. I played the eldest role for a very long time. I mean, I would take care of my brothers, cook for them. I learned to cook when I was like 7 years old because like, I mean, cook because my mom would be passed out drunk on the couch and my stepfather was an over the road trucker. And so he'd be gone forever, which was always a respite. And I would take care of them. I would fought with them too, though. So I want to be clear. My brothers and I fucking clashed. Why? Because as I look back on it, I understand that we were just understanding how you communicated through an environment of violence. We watched my stepfather beat the shit out of us. Our mom beat us. We watched them beat each other up, you know, plates getting broken and windows getting smashed and holes getting punched in walls. And so the way that my brothers and I communicated was violence. And so even though I tried to be the older brother and at times bring them up, ultimately the only thing that I ever did was hurt them because that's what this is how it works. And one of my younger brothers, I won't say his name, he tried to stab me and we were like 11 years old because that is just what we had come from. And now as adults, we talk about it. We spend time. I'm in Portland, they're in Indiana. But last time I was there, we spent a couple days together. And it was just this really wonderful, beautiful, amazing experience because part of it was I had to do a lot of work. I also years ago had to have conversations with them and explain why I behaved the way I behaved. And a lot of that was around in my teens, not spending time with them because I'm selling drugs. I'm running the streets. I'm in very precarious situations. And, you know, my way of keeping them safe was to never involve them in my life. My sister and I, our relationship, she has always been almost like a mother figure to me in a sense. I mean, when I walked the homecoming football game, when I won awards in wrestling tournaments, when I, you know, got all of these things in school, she was the only person who was ever there. And so, you know, and even in business, she still is the first person to support me. And so I'm super lucky with that. And so, yeah, being a sibling, it's odd though, because I don't think we'll ever have that same connection that other people have. Cause ours was just birthed in a different fashion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The way you were talking and some of your descriptions and stuff, the reason why I asked the question was, you know, when kids are put in parentified positions, right? Like they kind of have to take on the responsibility because the parent is failing there. It seems like at times that you end up developing a little bit more of that ability to overcome because you just are thrown into, I have to do this. I have to figure this out. I have to source the energy to take care of these other people and do it well before your years. I had three younger brothers. I have three younger brothers. I don't talk to them either anymore. Can't sit down with them and have conversations because there's also, a real lack of disconnect with them on our experiences. And one in particular, he can't even remember most of his childhood. Like, I mean, it's just dark gray spots for him because of, he had a lot. My older role, I learned quickly to not get hit was to just do exactly what you were told. And I became that compliant, and that ended up putting me in the position of raising three younger brothers. And unfortunately when kids raise kids, they don't turn out that great. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? It's like, that's a sure. sad consequence. You know, it doesn't matter how smart you are. It's not going to end well, for everybody there. You mentioned earlier too in your story, the moment that you stood in a mirror and kind of had that kind of wake up call, which, sometimes I think when the things click in our heads, there is this galvanizing moment in our life that we'll never forget. Can you talk about that a little bit more? Because I think sometimes people are always wondering if it ever happened yet or how it's going to look when it happens to them.
Yeah, here's what I think about it. I was in this really intense downward spiral. At 26 years old, my life was probably going to end pretty soon. It was real chaotic. I mean, out of control between the drinking and the smoking and I would be high. I mean, I was always a stoner as a kid. It was an escape mechanism. I didn't understand that then. I just liked to get high, right? But as an adult, like I was running two businesses. I was waking up in the morning, getting high. It was functional, right? It's like being a functional alcoholic. I'd have to be stoned from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to bed. And I'd be like, oh, I'm being creative, which I mean, there is truth to that, but ultimately it was about numbing myself. And so I was getting ready to go and do a wedding expo where as a photographer, I go and show all my albums. I go and show, you know, all the photos and the awards that I've been getting and all these things. And the night before I had got super drunk, like super drunk. And I woke up and I was running behind and I'm running in the bathroom trying to organize things. And I had this moment where I was like looking at myself in the mirror and I was buttoning up a size 4XL shirt and a size 47 pants that I couldn't even get around my fat fucking waist because I had destroyed my body. And I recognized that that was the moment I had promised would never happen. I said to myself as a kid, I'll never be this person who doesn't live up to the expectations that they have of themselves. And I had recognized that, you know, I had started doing some therapy in around 23, 24, but you know, it was just thing that people with money did in the neighborhood I lived in because of working the job that I worked and, you know, seeing the other people around me doing it. I was like, oh yeah, sure. Therapy, whatever. But I'd been in and out of therapy since I was like 7 years old. So this was nothing new for me, but I had never been serious about it. I would literally go to the therapist's office and tell them what I thought they wanted to hear. So they go, yeah, you're making progress. And
I connect with that. That was my first boys in therapy. Yeah. It's like, I'm going to tell you, and then I'm going to leave.
Yeah. And that's exactly what it was. Yeah. And so now I'm in this position in the bathroom, getting ready to go do this thing and recognizing that I'm a liar. I've lied to myself, I've lied to my partner, I've lied to my business associates, I've lied to the world. And at 26, I'm like, I'm probably gonna die soon. So what am I gonna do about it? And I think that we all have this moment of reckoning with us. It's a come into Jesus moment, as they say. And I'm not religious anymore, but I have this firm belief that the universe will give you signs, and when they do, you have to shut the fuck up and listen. And if you don't, you are going to continue down the path. And so this moment happened where it was just like, I will never explain it. I've never done that up to this moment. I had never done this thing where I looked at myself in the eyes, where I actually literally looked at myself in the eyes, my own reflection in that mirror, and I just wept. Because I was so, there was shame, there was guilt, there was hurt, there was anger, there was fear, there was all of the bevy of emotions that I had just stuffed down and drank away and smoked away and fucked away. All of them just like surfaced. And I had this really intense moment of thinking, from this moment, everything changes. Mm-hmm. And that is true, but then there was like a lot of work on the backside of that, right? It was a lot of this like, okay, how do you actually do this? How do I research and understand childhood trauma? How do I find the right therapist? How do I go to men's group therapy? How do I go to SA and NA and AA? And how do I put myself in these positions of educating and learning and stepping into love for myself across all spectrums? Food, sex, relationships, body, mind, soul, spirit, all of those things. And it was just kind of, I literally made a game plan. And part of it, I think it was interesting what had happened because I'd spent a couple years like diving further into it, but the progress that I really wanted wasn't happening. And I was 29 and I was starting to head into 30 and I was like, I have to leave Indiana. That's what it is. It kind of clicked. I was like, certain streets trigger me. And this is before like I had recognized that being triggered was even a thing. Cause I would hear it had just started becoming like polarizing and people were like, oh, I got triggered. And I'd be like, being triggered, what is that? That's bullshit. That's for people who are like, I would just be in this tangent in my head about it. And I recognized, oh no, being triggered is real, but it is about this emotional response to experiences or places or locations or scents. And I would get triggered everywhere I went in Indy. Certain streets, certain places, certain people. I'd have to be fearful. I'd have these moments. I'd have this immense shame and guilt about things that I'd done and places I'd gone and people I'd been with. And I was like, I walked into my living room. I was living with my girlfriend at the time. And I looked at her. I said, I have to leave and you can't come with me. And that was the first time we'd been together at that point for 7 years. I had never told her anything. You know more about me in 45 minutes than she knew in 7 years. Wow. And so I told her everything. I said, I have to go and you can't come with me, because if I don't, then whatever is next as this journey, it's never going to take shape. Because I'd been doing a little bit of the work. I'd been learning, educating, reading, studying. But it wasn't until I removed myself from there that I really grew. Mm-hmm. And that things really changed. And that was almost 5 years ago, right? And so now I'm looking at that and I feel like if I wouldn't have done that, I wouldn't be here. But it all circles back to the decision that I made in that moment, looking in front of that mirror and saying, today everything changes, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. And I got goosebumps hearing that, because, and I'm glad you shared that. And so thank you for doing that, because it is, those moments are available to people, and, but there is no way of predicting when they happen or when they kind of land on you. I mean, I describe December 17th as my rebirth day, because mm-hmm. that is my moment where it was the, I mean, it's this intense overwhelm of feeling and then this recognition all at once. And I did the same thing. Like I knew right then, I said, my life is never going to be the same again after today. Mm-hmm. Like this moment right here is the first step in a completely different direction. And it was, and for me, it was reading a couple of words that finally just clicked, and it brought back a traumatic memory that every time I thought about it, I cried. And here it was, I finally saw the memory for what it was and its impact on my life, like the trauma. And I did the same thing, like, you know, having the moment doesn't mean the work isn't there, for sure. There's a whole lot of it, but now you know the purpose and the point and the direction, and maybe you're learning, but you know what the outcome can possibly be at that point forward. I've used the analogy of it's like giving birth. And so for anybody that's, you know, a woman who's birthed anybody, and you, the anticipation of what labor is going to feel like, and you know, you've got everybody telling you what it's like, and you don't know, and you go in going, is this it? And, but when you actually go into labor, you know, you're in labor. And it's kind of like when you're wondering if you're having this moment, you know, you've just had the moment. Like, you don't have to ask if the moment yesterday was the big moment. Like it just, and it's hard to describe that feeling to people. Like,
yeah, you know. Yeah. You know, and I think sometimes you don't actually recognize it till you're in it. Right. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes you're like, am I doing it? And you have to step back and go, oh no, I am. I'm taking care of myself. I'm going to the gym. I'm doing yoga. I'm meditating. I'm going to therapy. I'm not cheating on my girlfriend. I'm not smoking crack. Whatever that thing is you're doing or not doing. And I think that's a really important place to kind of step back and acknowledge and just be thankful for yourself for like being that person. Mm-hmm. That's accountability.
Yeah, definitely. And that is a big thing. Like it's almost a, when you become accountable, there's something about that, especially again, if being wrong was, the reason why I air quoted that for this is because it's hard to suddenly become accountable, because sometimes accountability and blame, you know, are interchangeable, right? It could have been dangerous to admit your accountability in a circumstance, because somebody would have latched onto that, especially in abusive situations, mm-hmm. as, oh, you're taking blame. Well, of course you're to blame for that. And it takes a while to get to a place of understanding that that's not what accountability is. And yet accountability is the first, you know, like that's where you have to begin, is to say, I am responsible for some of these things. They may not be my fault, or, you know, given A plus B equals C, of course I chose this. Of course I did this and behaved in this way. Mm-hmm. But now I have to do something about that. And it does take a lot of discomfort, I think, in my opinion, and for me it did, to get over the, I'm not blaming myself for everything, right? But I have to be accountable for it. Like, 'cause I can't blame somebody else. Blame has no place here, you know, in terms of, you know, your own healing and growth, you know, I think.
Well, one of the things that really is awful about this for trauma survivors, for people who've been through traumatic situations, whether as a kid or adult, right? Because I work with a bevy of people in coaching, is that you're not responsible for the really bad, awful shit that happened to you. You're just not. And it takes a while to get to that place. You have to do the work to reframe those experiences in your mind, because it could have been like, was it something I wore? Was it something I said? Was it because I ate that for breakfast that day? It was blah, 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 blah. Like the list goes on. You can always find a reason to create fault, right? Finding reasons that it's not is much more difficult. And so slowly you get to this place where you recognize and you understand and you inherently and intrinsically feel like this wasn't my fault. But the caveat in that, which really is the shitty part of it, is it is still your responsibility to fix whatever happened. Not fix, let me not say fix, but to work through, to understand, to reframe, to change the way that you exist in the world, to change the way that you think about yourself and the scenario is you have to do the work. And that's what really sucks about the bad shit that happens to us that isn't our fault. The bad shit that happens to us that is our fault, that is 100% your responsibility. You are culpable. You are to blame. Now fix it. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Now, when I reached out to you, you know, one of your blog articles really connected with me. And so I want to talk about this before I get you into telling everybody about your book and everything, because that's really important. I want people to hear your approach and your process here. But, you know, we hear about the holy grail of healing as being able to forgive everybody for whatever it is that they did. And you and I, when I read your opinions on it, and your beliefs about that, I was like, yeah, I kind of feel that way too. Which is, and I've mentioned this before, and it's like, I'm not sure that that's how I feel better about is sitting there and handing out these platitudes to everybody of, I forgive you, I forgive you. That means I'm a better person now. And then I've grown in anything, because I know for myself that, you know, it's hard. It's hard to just forgive somebody for something. I can understand them. I mean, I can get it all down and go, I can see, you know, your own history. I can see the trauma that your life was enveloped in. I can see where, you know, the things that affected you and how you grew up and all those other things. I understand all of that. How do I say I forgive you to somebody that doesn't even like register for them? That to me, it's like, they're not going to change their behavior. They're still the same person. You know, what am I really doing with that? And that's where my internal struggle is. And I know you've really kind of thrown this around in yourself, and you have a you know, your own ideas and beliefs about that. You want to, what is forgiveness to you, and where is its role in your life?
Forgiveness is earned, like straight up. Like forgiveness is earned. Like you don't just get it. And this is interesting because in this community, what I will call, whether it's the coaching or mentoring or self-help or mental health community, we can wrap them all into one community. People push back on me on this so incredibly hard. And I stand by my words. And I believe 100% what I say to be true for me. And if it's not true for you, that's fine. I don't care. Here's what I think about forgiveness. As an analytical person, I can go and look at any scenario, any situation, and I can backdate it to the beginning and go, okay, this is the why, right? Mm-hmm. Especially in intergenerational trauma, I can go, oh, okay, that makes sense. Your father beat your mother, who their parents beat them, and then you got slave trade mentality and blah, 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 right? Goes on forever. Well, sure, but guess what? You're an adult, and you make choices, and you make decisions. And if you choose to abuse children, you're an asshole. Sorry. There's no two ways about it. You're a poor human being. And so that said, I can understand it and I can look at it and I can, even at times I resonate. I go, oh yeah, I get it. I understand why you did that. Do you get my forgiveness? No, not unless it's earned. What have you done to show me that you, A, have rectified the situation, B, you have learned about yourself, and C, that you've changed the behavior? Most people don't do those things. Mm-hmm. They just go, I'm sorry I smashed your face into a wall when you were 7 years old. Oh, great. I'm glad you're sorry. Well, we really worked that out. Really, thanks. And I'm being passive aggressive about it right now, but this is how I truly feel. I think this is a really important thing to kind of sit with, this idea that understanding gives you fuel to create what's next in your life. There are people in my life who I have forgiven, and there are people in my life who will never get it, no matter what. They just won't, because there's no way that a scenario will ever occur in which I'll go, okay, you've done all the things to make up for that action that was so deplorable that even when I think about it, it makes my body hurt, right? That person's never going to get forgiveness. And it's not an anger that I carry with me, but there's a chip on my shoulder. And I go, you know what? I'm going to fucking prove you wrong. And it becomes this really beautiful fuel that I use to keep myself motivated, because I do a lot and I extend myself really deep. And I have these moments of when I'm tired, I go, nope, fuck you, man. fuck you, woman. I'm going to keep going because of that thing that you've done to me. And I don't need forgiveness. People say, well, when you forgive, you get to let go. I don't want to let go. I want to remember every day so I keep moving forward so that my mission and my goals get completed. Because I think, and this is for me, and you may find that you need forgiveness to let go so you can move on forever and never think about it again. I want to think about it every day because that's how I'm going to change the world. And that works for me. So the thing is, you have to keep in mind is what works for you. What is your best case scenario? Is forgiveness a tool for you that's going to allot you the ability to move on and move forward and change your life? Or is it a tool that you can use where you go, you know, I'm not going to forgive you, but I understand it's better that we never talk to each other again. We don't really need to be in contact. And that moment, that experience, that thing is going to motivate me to become my best self. And so it's hard because like people will argue with it and say that forgiveness is a must if you want to heal. I don't think so. My life is awesome right now. Like literally because I've done a lot of the really deep, dark, dirty work and I love myself. I love my life. I love what I get to do for a living. And none of that involved forgiving the people who destroyed my childhood.
Right, right. I am smiling because I get that. Like, and that is, you know, a little bit before we were recording this, you know, it is my fuel as well. It's not, again, it's not the, you know, I need to be angry at the world all the time because I'm hardly that, but it definitely is like, man, I do not hand out gold stars unless there's action behind it. Like I just, in fact, it's 100%. Like, it's a passion for me to sit there and go, I don't really need to hear what you say to me. I need to see what you're going to show me. And I have forgiven people that have definitely demonstrated a complete shift in what they used to do. And I can, you know, and it's, I can with my heart actually forgive them because they did, like you said, they earned it. They actually became an entirely different person. They understood their story. They understood how they were living that out. They became better human beings for it. And that does to me, that's where it's like, yeah, I, you know, again, and it's even still understanding, but I guess maybe forgiveness isn't the right word. It's respect. Like those people earn my respect, you know? And, but the rest of it, you know, yeah, I mean, I think about, you know, one of my abusive relationships that I was in and I play some of those scenarios over and over in my head when I know that I need to stop that from happening to other people. Like I need to get pissed about that again. I need to feel like the violation again. I need to feel how angry that was because that's what moves me. That's what moves me to do what I do. And like I said, I was smiling because I hear everything that you're saying. Like there are some of us that is actually the fuel that, you know, that feeds the engine that gets us up standing on a pulpit, doing whatever it takes to do and to undo the injustices and unright the wrongs that are, you know, out there. Right, yeah. The wrongs. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's dismissive to tell people that they have to forgive each other.
Yeah, it kind of pisses me off too. Yeah, it's like
it's dismissive of our experience to be like, oh, if you want peace and happiness and it's white, you're a white worker and you're like, oh, you must forgive the world. No, that's not how it works. I'm sorry, you don't have to do that. What you do have to do is do whatever it takes to create the life that you want to have. And sometimes that means forgiveness, and sometimes that means saying, fuck you, I'm going to use this to do something better. Because I think about it like this, if I would have possibly just gone to this place where I go, oh, I forgive them, would my behavior have changed? Would I have a person of change? Would I have put myself in a scenario to be on the path that I now am if 8-9 years ago I would have just been like, you know what, I forgive them, but then nothing in my life changed, mm-hmm. Right? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't have a time machine. I don't want to find out either. So.
Right. Well, and I think it's, you know, it's important because, you know, like you pointed out, there's a lot of that messaging, but it really does come down to, is it, you know, where are you going and is your trajectory in a positive place? You know, if you need the forgiveness to be able to unlash yourself from everything that's holding you back, that may be your thing, but you know, like you, you know, undoing those angers and letting that bubble to the surface has been positive. You know, I don't have ulcers about it, you know, about the anger or anything like that. I have that propulsion for me mm-hmm. that actually draws heart out, right? Like love, like so mad that you want to love so much harder to make sure that you're taking mm-hmm. care of people or doing something of, you know, that's for other people there. And so I'm like you, it's like, I've had to set with that and go, I'm okay with that. Like I've heard your position, you over there at the forgiveness camp. And I know where I am. I know where my heart is. I know what I'm doing here. And I feel good about this, that like what mm-hmm. I'm doing is a net add, you know, yeah. onto life.
If it's true for you, that's all that matters.
Yeah. Yeah. So anybody listening to that, and if it's one of those sayings, like, you know, that's why I wanted you to talk with me about that, because I think some people do feel conflicted that they're being told one thing.
Yeah, it's easy to be conflicted, because also I think, my air quotes, if you're listening, giving people forgiveness becomes this thing that is a tool for you to somehow remove their culpability. And I think that you have to understand that forgiving people doesn't change anything, but working through it and doing the work and doing the things that you have to do is going to put you in the place that you want to be in your life. And I don't know, like, again, I don't know if there's a right or wrong way to deal with forgiveness, but I think that it's the low hanging fruit of healing in society. And people go, if you forgive, everything's going to be better. But I don't think that's necessarily true.
Right. Well, so I want to wrap up here because but I don't want to cut you off. And so I want to give you airspace here on your book. So you published a book called Think Unbroken, Understanding and Overcoming Childhood Trauma. And then you've developed, you know, like you've mentioned many times, so you've developed this life purpose and you've developed this, coaching and mentoring and workshops and stuff to be able to help with other adult survivors of child abuse. So talk please right now about all of that stuff that you do for other people. So anybody that's listening to this, if they're connecting with your story and your experience and want to follow up with you, I want them to be able to find you. You know, let's start with your book. What got you going on writing a book and publishing that?
Yeah, I love reading. It's always been this escape for me. Even as a kid, I would be in class in school reading. Not anything that they assigned to me, because I had no interest in most of it, but whatever it was. For me, it was always nonfiction as a kid. I didn't enjoy fiction because I didn't feel like I could wrap my head around it, but nonfiction autobiographies, always, 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 always. And as I started getting into this healing journey, I was reading all the self-help books, all of the self-help books, because I was just looking for anything that would help me kind of figure and sort things. And I noticed in the trauma space at the time, there was only a couple of books that really existed that I thought had anything of benefit. I'm not saying that there's not benefit in reading people's life story, but there was no like companion for this, right? And I thought to myself, okay, what do I really need as a person? If I were starting this journey over, what would I need? And it started as I was going to write a blog post that might have been 5,000 words. That was kind of how I viewed it. I'm just going to write a really big blog post. I'm going to dive into a bunch of stuff. And as I started the writing in the blog post, I was like, oh, this isn't a blog post. This is a book. Oh, this isn't a book. This is a workbook. Oh, this isn't a workbook. This is a guide. And so that's what it kind of turned into. So when you read Think Unbroken, it actually has writing exercises in it. You write in the book. Half of it is writing, half of it's understanding, right? Because I know that when I write things out, I get a better understanding of who I am in the world and a better understanding of myself. And so I took what I consider to be the most important concepts, which I could extrapolate on. I could write a book on every single part of the book. But I was like, okay, if I created a high level overview of the baseline of what it takes in terms of mindset and self-understanding, what would it look like? And so the further I got into writing that blog, the bigger that it became, the more it was like, oh, this has to become a book. And so I decided to write the book, and I started sending out to agents and stuff like that. And, you know, I love that we live in a time in which you can do whatever you want on your own terms, because months went by and I emailed hundreds of agents and I got no responses. And I was like, fuck it, I'm going to do it myself. And so I just self-published and I started a publishing company and I decided to do that. And it became an Amazon number one best-selling book, because I don't like the idea of people being barriers to what I want to accomplish in life. Now that all started, I would never have the book had I not started blogging a few years ago. And I started a blog called These 10 Aces, because I had recognized when studying Folletti's work, if you're not familiar, about the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Survey and Study, I answered yes to all 10 of those questions. And there are 10 really important questions that if you've understand and experienced trauma, you should check this out. It's called the ACE survey. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, I answered yes to all of these questions. And I was like, okay, I need to just write, I need to blog, I need to put it out. I need to talk about what I'm discovering, what I'm learning. And slowly that kind of started to transform. And next thing you know, I'm doing like talking at companies and workshops and co-working spaces and blogging, and the podcast started. And then, you know, all the things just started to transpire, and people were reaching out to me every day and saying, the things that you're putting out in the world are changing my life. I feel like I resonate with you. People are thankful. I get the most beautiful messages. Sometimes I get asshole messages too, because that's the nature of the world. But mainly it's just this beautiful sentiment of appreciation, which I'm so grateful for. It was never my intention to go down this path. I never thought that one day I would be mentoring other people into understanding the things that I discovered. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where it's at now, where I spend the majority of my time. I'm writing the next book right now, which is a deeper dive into this. But I'm coaching, I'm podcasting, and I'm just trying to help people understand what I discovered through experience. So I don't talk about anything I don't know, and I'm not a doctor, and I never went to college. I didn't even graduate high school on time, but I lived this, and I know what it's like to be at the bottom of what I call the vortex, this place where you are just stuck, where everything doesn't work, where you hate yourself, where you want to kill yourself. I've had a gun in my mouth before, right? And today I think about my life and I'm like, wow, it's so much different, but it was so hard to get to this place. And I know, and I don't like saying this, but I do believe it's true. If I can do it, like, you can do it. Like, there is a way. We will figure it out, right? Because it's mindset, and mindset is everything. And once you figure out how to navigate the way that you think about everything, then everything else changes. Mm-hmm. That's what I help people do. And that's what Think Unbroken does as a book and as a workshop, which now obviously I can't do. And I've hosted it in Bali and Singapore and America and around the world and back again. And I cannot wait to be able to do it again. And so for now, it's just online. It's resources. It's this. It's conversation. It's, you know, there's a lot of things to come, I hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, you said this, mindset over everything. You know, that it's shifting that, you know, explain how you do that for everybody. Like, when you're working with somebody, how do you do that mindset over everything?
It's about understanding. It's about this really in-depth, intrinsic look at who we are as people. There is a tremendous level of discomfort that I put clients through in conversation and understanding. And even in Think Unbroken, you will be uncomfortable reading this book. Why? Because it is through that we get to understand who we are. To this point, we've kind of nonchalantly continued our life as is and thinking like, oh, this is how it's supposed to be. Realistically, and the truth is, it's not. Unless that's what you want. And if that is, then you're probably not going to read the damn book anyway, so that's fine. But if it is the situation where you're like, okay, I want to change, you have to come to this place where you agree with where you make an agreement with yourself that you're willing to do whatever it takes. And that starts with mindset, right? Before you can start to really cultivate habits and ideas and changes that are long-term, you first have to get to this place where most people I talk to, 99.9% of people I talk to, whether they're coaching clients or workshop attendees, or they've bought my book, they all exist in this frame of shame and guilt. And it is that conversation in which we first have to adjust the way that we talk to ourselves. And so that's where mindset begins. What are the tools? What are the things that we have to do? How the fuck do we get you to a place, Ami, where you go, okay, I love myself. And then we do the rest of this shit. The rest of the shit doesn't matter until you can wake up in the morning, put your feet on the ground, and be okay with the person who's within this body. Be okay with your spirit and your soul and who you are. And that's what mindset is. Mindset is getting to that place, because you've been inundated. And I know we're running long here, so I'm going to try to wrap this up. We have been inundated with this idea that we have to be the person that we have been framed to be by our experiences leading up to this moment. And it is true, we are the sum total of all the experiences that we've had until right now. Even everything that's happened in this conversation, I cannot change. I cannot change a single fucking moment of my life. But I do have the ability from this second forward to invoke my choice and the decisions that I make to make my life what I want it to be. And I have to have direction. I have to have goals, and I have to have the tools in place to do those things, but without first having self-belief and self-love and compassion and empathy and sympathy and believing in my worth and value, none of those fucking things matter. So that's step one. How do we get to the place where I put my feet on the ground in the morning and I say, I'm good?
Mm-hmm. Man, you're amazing. I'm pointing at this. This is, because it, and that's not easy to do. Like, it takes time.
Fuck no, it's not.
It's not easy to do. I mean, I sit there and I think like 99% of the time I feel good about it, but then I'll have like a core shaking conversation where I'll have all kinds of doubt all over again and shame and, you know, all kinds of shit. But it is like, pick yourself up, get past that. Remember, you know, you can't.
There's something that you have to remember is that you're a human being. Mm-hmm. You're not a machine. If you're a machine, I could give you a tool right now and program you and say, from this moment forward, you're good. Nothing will ever impact you negatively again. You'll always be hunky-dory. Life will be amazing. You'll live this perfect existence. That's not real, right? What is real is that you will fall down. You will falter. You will break down. You will have moments. I do too. I regress. It is a part of human life. I catch myself doing things where I'm like, oh shit, I can't believe I just did that. Oh, what is that thing I just did? Oh, I lied there. Okay, we need to talk about that. We need to understand where the behavior is coming from. And when you get to the place that you have established the tools and understanding and you can recognize that and you can define the why, it's a faster return, right? And so what I mean is, initially, when you're first beginning this process, you might break down or regress and you're 5 weeks into bad behavior that you're trying to reform. And in 3 years and 5 years and 7 years and a decade later, you catch yourself doing that bad behavior. And in 8 seconds, you make a decision to change, mm-hmm. right? And that's where my life is now, but it didn't used to be. So that's the thing you have to remember. People think that suddenly, all of a sudden, everything is different. It's not that way. You are embedded in your experiences that led you up to right now. And so those will always inform everything that happens in your life. But that does not mean that they get to dictate your life.
Yep. Amen. Ah, man, this has been a great conversation with you. You know, sometimes I love what I do. I love the choices that I made. And, you know, and very much like you, I just felt like as I was doing my own educational process after my rebirth, it was like, okay, I'm learning. I was already reading. Nothing was connecting in the way that it needed to connect until again that morning on December 17th. And then it was, wow, this was hard. It was hard for me to penetrate what I needed to penetrate. I can imagine it must be really hard for other people too. What can I do? And so that's why I started podcasting, was I'm going to just tell you what I learned and I'm going to share it. I'm going to find other people that are doing this and I'm going to get them on here and we're going to talk to therapists and humans and, you know, and everybody, just because at some point, and I'll get emails, I'm sure just much like you do, where somebody will say it was that one episode when you said it this way, or that your guest talked about it in this way, that the light finally like came on. Mm-hmm. And I think that those are pure experiences. And so when I hear somebody, you know, kind of the same passion and also kind of that same geeky intellectual approach to it, because I'm an intellect in that way too. It's always exciting and it's always cool to, you know, kind of widen your world and bring people into your world, that you get to recognize that. And so I admire what you're doing. I think it's amazing. And appreciate everything that you've been putting forth. And so, you know, for everybody to find you, all your links to like your website, your book, your social media will be in the podcast notes. This has been outstanding. And like I said, we could have unpacked, and we unpacked a little bit more than I had planned on. But I mean, there's so much about you and what you've been going through and what your story is and what you can do for other people, that I just wanted to make sure that everybody got a chance to really know you, know your experience, because there's a lot of energy in it and a lot of things that you have to share and teach other people because of everything that you've already gone through. And this is the year for everybody to learn some resilience and to build that. This is where that resilience is tested. And I think that you're, you know, be a great person for some folks to reach out to learn how to build up that that mindset, that belief in ourselves, because if this year's taught us anything, is that like shit happens, man. Mm-hmm. It can happen at a fucking global scale and take us all down, and being able to rise up from, you know, whether it's unemployment or, you know, your job or being sick or whatever, the, you know, the millions of other things pounded on top of our traumas. If we have sat with those for a bit, that's a life skill. It's a life-saving skill. So, so I appreciate talking to you today, Michael. I really do.
Thank you. It's absolutely my pleasure. I appreciate it.
Awesome.
Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquercone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quercone, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.